Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
This is CBSi on the World. I'm John Batchelor. It is the spring-summer of 1936. Franklin Delano Roosevelt is running for re-election. His first term has been filled with turmoil because of what is said to be the New Deal's policies are unconstitutional or dictatorial, or in some fashion, overwhelming America with an authoritarian president who's seen as erratic and impulsive. At that moment, the Supreme Court, headed by Charles Evans Hughes, then the Chief Justice, delivers two opinions, bituminous coal, and then what is called Moorhead versus New York, the Tapaldo case, that rock the whole country. We're going to concentrate with Professor Richard Epstein of the Hoover Institution, he teaches law at NYU and the University of Chicago, on the Tapaldo case, the Supreme Court rejecting the ability of New York State to impose a minimum wage on women working in a laundry in New York City, owned by a man named Joseph Tapaldo. Tapaldo has been in jail awaiting trial. He believes his rights under the 14th Amendment were violated. He was not allowed the due process. He also claims in his appeal to the court that the minimum wage law in New York that is in place is unconstitutional, just like the Atkins versus Children's Hospital law of 1923 was overturned by the court. I welcome Richard at this moment to comment, not only because it's a fascinating turn of American labor history, but also because the whole country was enraged after the decision came down, saying the Supreme Court is out of touch and dictatorial and must be changed. This put the administration in a strong position because heretofore it had been seen as on the defensive, attacking the Supreme Court's decisions in overturning New Deal laws. But now the Republicans, the editorialists, a vast number of the newspapers agreed that the court had overstepped its bounds. And that gave FDR an advantage in the summer campaign. And once he was well and reelected in 1936, led to, we could make the argument, that the decision that Roosevelt made that was very poor, which was packing the court law in the winter of 1937. Richard, I welcome you to comment on this because it reminded me exactly when I read through the history of the enraging of the Democratic Party because of decisions made by the present Supreme Court, which is seen as out of touch and dictatorial. Good evening to you, Richard.
Yeah, well, there certainly is a parallel with respect to that element. Let me go back and sort of set the stage. In 1905, there was an important case called Lochner against New York. And that particular decision held by Justice Rufus Peckham that a 10-hour a day minimum wage, maximum hours law was unconstitutional because it abridged the freedom of contract, the liberty of contract of both employers and employees. And what he did is he struck down that law. What that did is it took place at the exact same time. And I think the irony has to be observed that there was massive improvement in the laboring conditions of workers in the United States. Real wages went up quite decisively in this particular period, because it turns out if you do the economics correctly, the minimum wage law or the maximum hour law is a kind of restraint on a behavior that reduces the joint output of workers and employers alike, and that leads to a smaller pot. But this was the New Deal period, and the sort of free market economics that I practice and believe in were very much out of step at that particular point in time. So for the next 30 or so years after that decision, people were targeting it for all sorts of attacks of one kind or another, and it turned out the attacks were made not only by the Democrats, but also by the progressive Republicans, for example, Charles Evans Hughes, who essentially basically struck down the law in 1937 in a case called West Coast Hotel v. Harris. Well, Morris, the Moorhead v. Tamaldo case was the last breath of the old order. And these guys come forward and they say, look at these earlier cases. They were by and large oblivious to the politics of the situation. And they said, you know, the interference with contract is going to hurt both sides to that arrangement. And what they did is they basically struck down the law. Ironically, I would tell you that law would be struck down today, but on very different grounds. In the 1920s and 30s, it was quite fashionable to believe that protective legislation for women would pass constitutional muster. And so in many cases, what happens is you have these separate ways. Today, if you did this, there would be a per se violation of the Equal Protection Clause on sex discrimination, and the statute would be struck down for other reasons. So it's not as though when you start looking at modern courts, they refuse to put their hands in labor markets. What they do is they hit different kinds of pressure points. They're much more worried about discrimination than they are about a statute which binds both sides to the party. Now, the consequences when you start striking down these statutes and so forth is that many times the women who do well in a market situation may not do well if the laws are reversed. So when they had a case called Mueller against Oregon and they upheld a minimum wage law for women, the women were fired and some Asian Chinese, I believe, took their places. So it's very complicated to understand which way it goes economically. But politically, it is a complete winner for defenders of the minimum wage law. I think that's even true today. The way the debate goes today is not a constitutional debate. It's a question of, do we want it at $10 an hour, $15 an hour, $50 an hour? You pick the number that you can, and the Supreme Court will generally accommodate you. So when you want to take it forward and you mention the abortion cases, it's pretty clear to me that the electoral sentiment has been by and large in favor of protecting constitutionally a woman's right to abortion, right? It's the absolute inverse, right? In one case, they were terrible for striking down a law, and now they're being terrible for upholding the law. It's not judicial restraint or judicial activism that matters. It's the nature of the underlying cause. And so if you look at the popular sentiment in the United States, probably about two-thirds of the people, many liberal Republicans amongst them, are basically in favor of constitutional protection for abortion rights. And so this puts the Democrats on the offensive and the Republicans on the defensive, not because of judicial restraint. That's what the Dobbs case is a model of, judicial restraint. It puts it there because they're out of touch with the public at large, and you have to pay electoral consequences. I think in this particular case, many states will actually pass laws that will return the status quo ante of Roe, and the issue may be a little bit less decisive by the time we get to November, but there's no question that as a political matter, the Dobbs decision hurt the Republicans in what might have otherwise been a very strong Republican year.
I'm struck by the politics of this, as well as, thank you, Richard, the law, the background of the law, because you have diverse voices in 1936. This is Hamilton Fish, who was FDR's congressman, saying this was the Tipaldo case was a new Dred Scott case condemning millions to economic slavery. And William Allen White, the great editorialist, said this is a new battle for human freedom. These are strikingly similar to remarks that we hear now about Dobbs. Mm-hmm. And FDR, then, because he was afforded such an overwhelming victory, you know, as Maine goes, so goes Vermont. You remember the phrase.
Yes, I do remember that.
Most everything. He then was led to be empowered to actually move the threat of Supreme Court packing to a bill that that Congress entertained. That was rejected. But again, the parallel is in place today. I do not believe that the so-called court packing, or in some fashion to contain the Supreme Court by adding members to it, I don't believe that that has disappeared. I believe it's dormant right now because we're in the midterms, but we could see that it would return in the presidential cycle in 2024.
I think it could return. I don't think it's likely to prevail. When Biden put together his commission, they got all sorts of testimony from all sorts of people who said that the number 9 is extremely important institutionally for the way in which the court works. the way the deliberations start to take place, the way certiorari is granted, the way in which you argue, the way in which factions start to develop. So there was very little support for that that came out in that report. I think it's more likely if there's going to be a constitutional change, it will be on term limits. Every other country in the world has term limits on its Supreme Court. The United States has a constitutional protection for an indefinite term on good behavior, which means just about any time you're there for life. And there's a lot of uneasiness about that, because if you remember one of the charges that was made in 1936, it was nine old, stress the old, men who were dictating this. And the Supreme Court is a body which is generally pretty old because of the length of the terms in question. So if you could figure out how to overcome the transitional difficulties with sitting justices, I think that reform is more likely to start to take place than the one about expanding the court. There's just too much opposition to that particular situation. But in the short run, the Democrats' strongest issues are two, the J6, January 6th, and Donald Trump, the gift that keeps on giving, and I think the abortion cases. But on the other side, they have to deal with all the questions associated with the southern border, with inflation taking place, high mortgage rates. They don't have to face unemployment yet, but people are very, very uneasy about this, a catastrophic energy policy and so forth. I think in the end, the abortion issue will not be as strong as the pocketbook issues that you're talking about when it comes to the coming election.
Speaking to Professor Richard Epstein of the Hoover Institution, who is doing me the favor of entertaining a what if from 1936 to 2022. We're going to turn now to the new terms of the Supreme Court. There are many big decisions that Richard will have to comment on before we come to the oral arguments. I'm John Batchelor.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.